Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to talk about health a little bit today to start the show. Good health care, essential for our well-being, but it's not always easy to come by, especially in rural areas. And my guests today are here to talk about how an organization that has Wisconsin roots is working to change that in rural Latin American communities. My guest today with us by phone, Tony Hiss, is the author of The Long Road from Quito, Transforming Healthcare in Rural Latin America. He's also a staff writer was a staff writer at the New Yorker for more than 30 years. Tony Hiss, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
Great to be with you, Larry, and David.
Yeah, with me in the studio, Dr. David Gauss is the founder and executive director of Andean Health and Development. And Dr. David Gauss, welcome. Thank you so much for being with us in person today.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
So, as you listen to these two guys talk, how do you define good health care? Have you ever had a difficult time getting care you needed because of where you live? Are you interested in what's going on in terms of health care in other parts of the world? Certainly, there's, I think, a wonderful story that's going on with the Andean Health and Development Organization. And I'm really glad to be able to tell you and have our guests tell you all about it. Questions for them, you can join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dr. David Gauss David, you have a heck of a story here. Your journey from becoming, you were in accounting first, I think.
That's right.
Tell us your story of how you came to be a physician practicing in Ecuador.
It's a long story. I'll be brief about it. As an accountant, I never actually worked in accounting, but discovered my senior year that I did not want to be an accountant. Too late to change. Graduated in accounting and decided to do volunteer work and did something like Peace Corps work and volunteered at a place in Quito, basically an orphanage and a family development project in Quito. Discovered a lot of the health problems that Ecuadorians were facing. Met a guy doing tropical disease research in Ecuador and got excited about medicine and came back. And actually, the president of the University of Notre Dame, where I had graduated from, a great guy named Father Ted Hesburgh, was very helpful and instrumental in making sure that I could come back and do my post-baccalaureate pre-med things at Notre Dame, and then arranged for, through the help of actually a wonderful woman who you would all know as Ann Landers, to help us, to help me get into medical school and pay for that. And so that went on for about 7 or 8 years, came back to Wisconsin to do my residency, and then worked full-time on the faculty for the Department of Family Medicine, but at a hospital in Milwaukee, St. Luke's, and then moved to Ecuador in 97, always with this idea. The plan was always to go back to Ecuador. I really didn't want to be a physician in the United States because my passion was born out of my experience in Ecuador.
And what was the health what's the experience like in Ecuador? What are the health concerns there? What were they when you started there?
Well, they're the typical things that you'd see in this country. So Ecuador is living an epidemiologic transition, which Tony talks about very nicely in the book. And so you have all the typical things that you see in a low-income country, like infectious diseases, motor vehicle accidents, but you also see all the new chronic diseases and cardiovascular diseases. And so it's the double threat of these diseases that wreak havoc on people that have limited access to services.
Tony, talk about how you got involved and maybe recap a little of your history with the things that David was just talking about.
I heard about David through some friends as this extraordinary person, and he was kind enough to start inviting me down to Ecuador. And as soon as I met him, I thought, this is a story that needs to be told more widely. I've seldom met someone who's had such a unique combination of passion and compassion. David, a remarkable person who manages to seem remarkably unremarkable. Just a sweet, lovely guy when you meet him, but always, always pushing to get further and further and further. And that's one of the things that's so remarkable about what's been done down there, is that every time they achieve something, they never see it as a stopping point, but only as a stepping stone. And as I'm sure David was about to tell you, after his 12 years of learning to prepare to go to Ecuador, he got there and said, that's when my education really began, when I began to learn what was really needed and what was the differences between life in Quito, the capital up in the mountains, and life down in the countryside.
Yeah, and maybe talk, you do recap a lot of the history of the tiers of medicine, the big times of medical transitions. Talk a little about some of those highlights and how they relate to the AHD hospitals we know today.
Well, first I'll say something about the city where they've set up their new hospital, Santo Domingo. It's now almost accidentally the third largest city in the country, and yet the one that is least known about. There's the big city Quito up in the mountains and the big city Guayaquil on the coast. But this city was 50 years ago just a dusty village that two new roads were happening to come through, and an enterprising radio station guy
began
to broadcast throughout the country, this is the land of opportunity. This is the crucible of the new Ecuador. And he was able to be heard by lots and lots of people because the great new innovation at that time was transistor radios.
And inexpensive ones.
So everyone flocked to Santo Domingo, which is, by our standards, an odd place. It seems more like an endless suburb than a city. And the hospital that David and his partner, Diego Herrera, have set up is sort of like the first permanent institution in this very provisional city. And they now have a catchment area of people from the surrounding neighborhoods of 600,000 people. So they're available to an awful lot of people who never had quality health care before.
Yeah, that's just an amazing story. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. If you have a question or comment or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. David, how did your, when you first arrived, I'm sure you, I know you had some ideas and thoughts about how you were going to proceed. Tell us how, what you had in mind and how those thoughts evolved over time.
So I went to Ecuador as a family physician and with a master's in public health. And so I thought the keys to the kingdom of good health was prevention and health education and health promotion, and went to this small community. Did a feasibility study. They told us that they would. We also wanted to see if this community would be interested in paying some small amount for healthcare services. Mm-hmm. And in this study that we did, they said we'd pay for healthcare services, but create mechanisms that put those services within our reach. And oh yeah, we need a hospital. And we put the oh yeah, we need a hospital idea on the shelf and said to ourselves, everyone needs a hospital. Opened up a small facility to try and test if they really would pay for some meager amount for it. And in that 12 months, as Tony alluded to before, is where I began to cut my teeth on what it meant to be a physician in a rural area in a low-income country and what it was like for patients to gain access. And so what I learned is lots of things. First of all, you cannot do, and this is an important point that Tony brought up in the book, it's very difficult to do curative services in a vacuum or preventive services in a vacuum. You need both of them. If you don't have a good curative service model, people won't access it. If they don't access it, you don't know what the diseases are to try and prevent down the road. So you really need both of those at the same time. And so our switch was to look more at providing good curative services, and that went from having an outpatient facility to saying, hey, it looks like we need to build a hospital here because there are no hospitals around here. And then we remembered that they actually told us that in the feasibility study. So we embarked on building a small 15 to 20 bed rural hospital, and also continued to do a lot of education and prevention and promotional activities as well. And then we had to figure out how to be a hospital and how do you make a hospital work? How do you run a hospital? And then I remembered, oh yeah, I was an accounting major in undergrad. I should know something about this. And so it just became a series of events over the next 7 years that helped us figure out how to provide high quality care in a hospital setting with outpatient facilities, but try and do it in a financially self-sustainable way. We wanted to move away from the missionary model of Mesh, and we're not a missionary organization. I have no problems with that from a philosophical or theological perspective, but the typical missionary hospital tends to be eternally dependent on outside funding, and we did not want to be that kind of an organization, and we wanted it to be quintessentially Ecuadorian.
And that involved and also included the folks who were involved in medicine, or that you wanted to be involved in actually treating others, to be Ecuadorian.
Right. So I'm the only American there. So, and the place runs better when I'm not there.
Tony, do you think that's true?
Well, I haven't seen it when he's not there. But the whole point is that it feels like something Ecuadorians are doing for themselves. And David's partner, Diego Herrera, is Ecuadorian and himself a person who, not an accounting major, but he straddles many different cultures. He's a grandnephew of a former president, so he grew up sort of scampering around the Ecuadorian White House. But he also is a wide-ranging intellectual and a doctor who deeply cares and who listens to his patients and to other doctors, which allowed David and Diego to become teaching doctors as well as doctors. So the model is Ecuadorians for Ecuadorians, and then David said he dusted off his accounting skills and came up with this unique solution where the Ecuadorian Social Security Administration allows their members to come to the hospital, and their reimbursement payments for the services rendered at the hospital actually is more generous than what it costs the hospital to provide, since Diego and David are such good penny pinchers. So that meant that they could use the surplus to pay for procedures for people who had no money or tiny amounts of money. And that way they could fulfill their other commitment, which was nobody would ever be turned away. Everyone is welcome.
Oh. It's a wonderful story. Joan in Managua has something for us. Let's go there. Joan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was a Peace Corps volunteer many decades ago, and my son was born there. His dad's a other Peace Corps volunteer, but I just went back in 2014, and I was in Ibarra to teach at the St. Vincent's Hospital neonatal resuscitation, because I'm a nurse midwife. But I remember well how rural Santo Domingo was. Oh, my gosh, to think it's 600,000. It's what a wonderful thing you're doing.
Thank you. I would like to say that the word rural is difficult to describe. People often say, well, if you're working in rural Ecuador, what are you doing in a city of a half a million people? And the answer to that question is more anthropological than it is density. Most of those people, well, 30, as Tony alluded to, 30 years ago, there were 75,000 people or less in that city. Now there are 400,000, 600,000 people. Guess where they came from? They came from the countryside. So in terms of their cosmovision, they're still wired very very rural, very pre-modern, and I don't mean that disparagingly, but just anthropologically. And so one of the things that we needed to do is to make sure that we found the right physicians and nurses to take care of these patients. And we initially invariably went to Quito to find these physicians. And Quiteños have about as much in common with someone from Santo Domingo as I have in common with someone from Santo Domingo. But they felt that they knew them better. So we realized that there was this choke here, these clashes between patients and physicians. And so we decided to train our own physicians and started our own residency program. And that way we can form these people and help them figure out how to approach these patients in their own context. And context is the key for everything. And so Ibadah is a beautiful city, and we'd love to do a project there someday. But I'm glad you were able to make it to Santo Domingo, ma'am.
Joan, thank
you. Yeah. If I could add, my 2 years is actually in Cusubamba, which is in the north rural area of Latacunga. And we had our doc come only for a few days from Quito. And I understand the people from the city. It's a big difference. It's a big difference. So I appreciate your comments. And again, so full of gratitude that you're out in the campo.
Joan, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. We're talking about transforming healthcare in rural Latin America and kind of in other parts of the world as well with our two guests. Tony Hiss is the author of the book Long Road from Quito, Transforming Healthcare in Rural Latin America. And the book is really about the work of Dr. David Gauss, who's our other guest today, founder and executive director of Andean Health and Development. Call in with your own questions, comments, experiences. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jane Rotunda, our on-air producer today, Nigel O'Shea, our director. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. As I said at the beginning of the show, the World Health Organization says that more than a billion of the 7.5 billion people in the world do not have access to basic health services. And we're talking with a native Wisconsin physician, one of our guests today, Dr. David Gauss, who is founder of Andean Health and Development. And Tony Hiss. Tony is an author. He's written The Long Road from Quito, a great book that talks about transforming healthcare in rural Latin America. Wonderful to have them with us. Questions or comments for them, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Tony, just to go back to you for a minute, we were talking about the differences in sort of attitude or background of someone from an urban area trying to work in a rural kind of setting. And you talk about that in a bit of depth in the book. And frankly, it's not only Ecuador that has that problem. We have that problem or that issue challenge, let me say, right here in Wisconsin.
And right here in New York too, for that matter. But David managed to become a sort of trilingual person. In addition to being speaking English, in addition to speaking and understanding the way people in Quito, the Quiteños, think, he was able to figure out the way people out in the countryside think. And sometimes it's a matter just of these new conditions, chronic conditions that are affecting people down in Ecuador now that they're living longer, like diabetes, conditions that can be tamed but not cured, require constant attention by a patient. But the traditional thought in the countryside, as David told me, was that if you had to take pills for more than 2 weeks, you were seeing a bad doctor. So they would stop taking pills, and then the doctors from Quito who were working for David would say to him, they're not following directions, they're not taking the pills. So it's a matter of learning how to talk to people in language they can understand as much as anything else.
Yeah, it's to add to that, what Tony just said, the key word in all this is context or contextualization.
Okay.
You really have to meet people on their own terms. And I think that's what you're alluding to when you say these challenges we face right here in Wisconsin. But over and over, we would see physicians come at patients with their biological solutions to medical problems without figuring out how to contextualize it for the reality that that patient is living. And it might be different than what the physician had in mind, but if the physician wins and the patient loses, it's an unsuccessful interaction.
Yeah, that's... And I was struck by some of the health threats in rural Ecuador and other places, quite a few other places as well. One in particular that I hadn't thought about was snake bites as a serious health issue.
Yeah, that's
we were driving down from Quito, and by the way, as a way of not being on the scene all the time, David lives in Quito and commutes to Santo Domingo and to the small town with the first hospital, Pedro Vicente Maldonado. And that's a three-hour drive. It used to be a seven-hour drive, but the two towns are also about an hour and a half away from each other. As we were driving down the hills, David said at one point, oh, we just crossed the snake line. There are no snakes up in the mountains. So the Quito doctors not only don't have the language, they really don't know much about snakes. And yet there are pit vipers down in Santo Domingo and Pedro Vicente Maldonado with that can cause terrible damage to someone. They disrupt the blood system, but they also disrupt and begin to sort of crumble muscles from within as a way of pre-digesting a victim. And that's when David first got started, as he said, lightning bolts struck him, and the first one was a seven-year-old boy who came in and said to him, "Doc, voy a morir, doctor, I'm going to die." And David had never heard such a thing from an infant, from a small boy, and had been bitten by a pit viper, tried to rush him to Quito, but he died on the way. And that's when he began to know something was terribly wrong with what he had come to Ecuador thinking he needed to do.
I think the snake bite story is a good one to help explain some of these differences between prevention and curative services. You could talk about how to prevent a snake bite all you want, yeah. But you know what? When you get one, you have to find a place that can administer anti-venom, and there's all kinds of other remedies that are out there. However, none of them really work. The only thing that really works is anti-venom, and so you have to have it. And some of them require a cold chain, and they have to be refrigerated. Fortunately, some of the newer ones aren't like that anymore. But you have to have it, and then you have to know how to administer it. And so we've managed over 150 snake bite cases over the last 15 years. And I think those are some of the rare examples where we actually have saved some people's lives doing that. But then there's also the contextualization, because the patients then get this condition. Most of them get a condition, well over half of them, called serum sickness, which is an expected complication. That's just a minor problem of muscle aches and some low-grade fevers and some joint pains for a couple weeks after you've been given the anti-venom. And so you have to make sure you educate them on these things. Otherwise, they think that you did something you spook them, or you did something inappropriate to them. So,
gosh, well, there's an interesting discussion in the book as well. I thought about how we look at healthcare and how we deal with healthcare. There is a stress on eliminating a disease. Some people say, okay, if we can eliminate this disease, then things are going to be a lot better, and I guess it probably would, but there are other ways to, if you're going to spend your money, how do you best spend your money? And I think your approach is a little different.
Well, so you have to find a healthy balance between prevention and curative services, like we talked about before. In the United States, it's funny, there's kind of a double standard. When people in the United States and part of our healthcare system, the vast majority of healthcare dollars are spent on curative services, and a small fraction, 10-15%, is spent on health prevention. Yet when we talk about places like Ecuador and other low-income countries, our battle cry is it has to all be prevention. And so you have to find a balance between those two extremes. And disease elimination versus disease control is an important aspect. But even within the disease control programs that you see in places like Ecuador that are sponsored by the Pan American Health Organization and embraced by local governments in these countries, they tend to create parallel healthcare systems or these things called vertical disease programs to manage those things because they don't trust their own healthcare system to be able to manage them themselves. So it's a real challenge to try and figure out how to incorporate all those prevention and curative services within the essential healthcare framework instead of having to create these extra structures to try and address those things.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, as you were talking, I thought back to the people that the doctors and the people that you trained. How did you go about recruiting and educating the staffs that you have?
So that's an ongoing challenge. Finding people to work in our facilities has always been a challenge. I can tell you things that don't work. Trying to find quiteños or people from the larger cities to come to the countryside to train, they might have had a better educational experience than people that went to medical school and smaller schools in the countryside, but they're not really committed to being there over the long haul. They want to get back to Quito, and people tend, from the larger cities that go work in the countryside, tend to hold their breath while they're out in the countryside until they can get back home. And so we had a pretty significant attrition rate when it comes to training our physicians. And so we would much rather have someone who comes from the countryside, maybe has not had the exact same educational experience, but their attitude is correct from our perspective. And it's their people that they're taking care of. And so you know they're going to stay around. So trying to find rural people to do the work in rural Ecuador seems to be the better formula than to fall into the temptation of taking people from the city.
Yeah. Tony, you described the hospitals, the buildings themselves. You did a nice job of that, I thought. Talk about that, what they are like.
Well, if it makes sense to say it, the hospital in Santo Domingo, Hesburgh Hospital, named for Father Ted Hesburgh, is a building and a surrounding. The hospital itself has a bedside manner. As soon as you drive in the gates, you're met not just by a gleaming structure, but by an extraordinarily beautiful garden with remarkably planted with flowers, lawns, palm trees. It's a feeling of immediate welcomingness and peacefulness and calmness, that you're in good hands, that you've arrived at a wonderful place. The building itself is a one-story building because it's an old high school that they were able to get cheaply. And it's got some columns out front so that it looks like a place that's taking itself seriously. That was something David decided was important. The White House of Ecuador in Quito has columns in front. You come inside, there's marble floors, but there's also a flat-screen TV showing who's next to be seen. So it's a wonderful mix of modern and just, it's a building that looks like it could be a children's museum, it could be a hip art museum. It's sort of like an embassy from the land of health.
Yeah. And to provide a little more context to that, one of the things that we heard in our feasibility studies from people over and over again was that hospitals were cold, dark, dirty places where you go to die. That's the perception of people out in the countryside. And so we decided that these hospitals have to look good from the outside to attract people. And for the first 6 months in our first hospital in Pedro Vicente Maldonado, a few people showed up because they thought it was a hotel or they thought, this place is way too nice. This can't possibly be for us. And so with time, that eventually evolved. But we spent an awful lot of time, my wife Elizabeth spent a lot of time figuring out the right colors to put in the hospitals to create a sense of serenity and peacefulness, yet high energy and things like that. So we put a lot of time into that to try and overcome that perception that people have of the countryside.
And there's a great photo of the front of the hospital in the of several great photos actually in the book, but it really does look impressive. Yeah. I'm wondering, has the hospital or those hospitals, have they resulted in more of an influx of folks to those communities? How have the hospitals changed the communities themselves?
The best example I think of that would be in our first hospital in our small community of Pedro Vicente Maldonado. It's a county with about 15,000 to 20,000 people in it. The county seat has about 5,000 to 8,000 people in it. The mayor came up to us one day and said, you know, Gauss, we've got the cleanest main street in all three county seats in this part of the country. You know why that is? Because we figured out, based on the hospital experience that we've had with Andean Health and Development, that clean places are more attractive places. And that has spilled over into town. So they've hired more the garbage trucks. They've hired more people to keep the streets clean. And so that was one very interesting byproduct that I would have never thought would happen. But because we have more patients coming in from other cities to that hospital, there's a larger economic base. There are more businesses that have popped up, and I think it's probably had a little bit of an influence that way.
And how's the patient-doctor relationship? How does that, is it different from what we might expect here?
It is.
What traits resonate differently for Ecuadorians?
Well, first, let's start with traits that resonate the same. There still is a predominantly, I know I have the answer for you, physician mentality. And I say that disparagingly, but also respectfully, because I get that, because I'm from that same model, right? But we really hope that, again, going back to this contextualization, that our physicians are doing something different. They're trained as family physicians, and so we don't focus only on the biological but also on the psychological and the social aspects, and that's how you negotiate with patients. And so we work very hard to do that with them, and so we like to believe that relationship that our physicians and our nurses and our whole staff have with patients is a little bit different than what you see in the rest of the country and maybe in places even in the United States.
So you know your clients, you know the people who come. You learn to you hopefully learn about them and learn, not necessarily become friends with them, but be close to it maybe.
Absolutely. And so you see them every day. You see them in the local stores, and you understand. I'll never forget a guy who came in with tuberculosis in the early years, and I saw him a week later in a little corner store, and his children were all malnourished. And it became a lightning bolt for me that they're all malnourished because he can't work because he's got tuberculosis. He can't put food on the table. And so it's a great example of how health affects the entire family. And so as a physician, you have to make sure that you take the whole family into consideration. Those little examples.
Tony, how do you see what David has done replicating or working in other parts of maybe Latin America or other parts of the world?
Well, I think what David and Diego have been able to show is that this is a missing piece in the healthcare delivery system. But it has between the preventive side, which of course is important, as David was saying, and the large institutional hospitals, there's room for these smaller hospitals, nonprofit hospitals, staffed by family physicians. So, sometimes family physicians who are gone through a residency where they sort of become specialists in everything rather than just specialists in one thing. And they're sometimes called the Swiss Army knife of medicine, sometimes called the five-star doctors. That a place like that, that has solved its financial problems, that's run by local people, if it has family medicine doctors and maybe a surgeon who's part of the team, can handle the 20 most common causes of people getting hospitalized. Pneumonia, pregnancy complications, broken bones, appendectomies. That this is doable and affordable. And David not only had to make this happen in Ecuador, but it was going against a tide of opinion which had persisted for decades that the only way to go into the poorest countries was to talk about preventive services. And even when there was an international meeting in Alma-Ata in Kazakhstan in 1978 that proclaimed the amazing goal of health for all by the year 2000, this became the prevailing model and then was superseded by one which concentrated just on mothers and infants. So now that they have this hospital in a town of 600,000 people, they are much more visible. And this is also partly something I think you have to credit or blame Father Ted Hesburgh for, because he was someone who, as a mentor, always pushed people to take one step farther than they were planning to take. He would always say, what you're doing is great, but when are you going to do something important? Well, now David and Diego have done something very important.
What's next for Andean Health and Development?
Yeah. So we think about that a lot, and one of the answers is to continue to build out infrastructure and extend this model. We're not sure how to what extent we would like to do that. Building more hospitals is problematic. It's challenging. And as I get older and my hairs get grayer, that becomes less appealing to me. So our emphasis really is to try. We're not there to try and change Ecuador's healthcare system by creating our own healthcare infrastructure. That's not the purpose of this, right? Our goal is to get people to begin to question the current healthcare system, and to really probe where its problems are and look at it critically. And so one of the ways to do that is to do research on the kinds of things that we see as a challenge that are public health threats to our population every day. And a lot of that is a critique on the healthcare system. And so we have a journal that comes out, which is actually pretty cool in a place like Ecuador, where there is very little academic production in the health services, to have a journal that comes out every 4 months, and we address a lot of these issues in that. We also write medical manuals, and we also want to measure some of the impact that we're having in our communities. So it's a 3- or 4-pronged approach that attends to try and address some of the policy issues that you see at the global level by sharing our experiences.
Do you have, is there a website, a place where people could go to learn more about your organization?
There is, Larry. Thanks for asking. AndeanHealth.org is our website that has, that gives access to our journal, to our medical manuals, and to all the things that we're doing on a day-to-day basis. In fact, if people are interested in purchasing the book, they can go to the website and purchase it there. They can also just go to Amazon and buy it there.
Sure.
But we love to have people look and see what we're doing in our
website. And again, the name of the site?
AndeanHealth.org. So Andean, it's not Indian.
Andean.
And Andean is the adjectival form of the name Andes, after the Andes Mountains. So.
Well, I say to both of you, salute. I think that came up in the... In the book somewhere, which is Spanish for health.
Health, that's right.
Yes.
For health, and I wish you both good health, and I really respect your work, both of you, and thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Larry.
It's
been a great pleasure. Tony Hiss is the author of the book Long Road from Quito, Transforming Healthcare in Rural Latin America. It's a wonderful book. It was a great, interesting read with lots of some really good stories to go along with what David Gauss and his crew down there have done. He is Dr. David Gauss, founder and executive director of Andean Health and Development. And Tony Hiss, author of many things, but the latest, Long Road from Quito. Thank you both again for being with us today.
Thank you, Larry.
You're so welcome.
And speaking of books, if you want a good read, where do you go? Sometimes you go to a library, and we're going to be talking about libraries and what's going on with libraries in Wisconsin next. Here on the Ideas Network, I'm Larry Mueller.